Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is August 15th, 2005. Today's session is entitled Accompaniment, Not Colonialism, presented by Anne Basie and Mary Campbell. Let's listen in.
Well, welcome to all of you. My name is Mary Campbell and I work for the Division for Global Mission. I am the companionship person for Latin America. Basically, what that means is that in the Division for Global Mission, we're all organized in teams, and there are things called continental teams. We have teams for Africa, Europe and the Middle East, Asia, and Latin America. And I am part of the Latin America team, and we are involved with the relationships with Latin America. The desk director and I work together. Her primary responsibility is relating to the 22 companion churches that we relate to in the region. You know, there are more churches, there are more countries than that, but those are the relationships that we have with Lutheran churches in those countries. And my part of it is to work with companion synod relationships. One of the things we thought we'd start out by saying is, why did we even choose this accompaniment as a topic? You know, first of all, how many of you heard accompaniment before or studied about it?
Yeah.
A couple people. Okay, well, that's good. Because this is really the emerging vision for mission, for global mission. You know, we're going to talk a little bit about what it was before and what it is now. But the reason it's so important is whenever there's a shift, a paradigm shift, it takes people a little while to figure out and work with it. And we're finding, especially with the companion synod relationships, which there are many, many, many in the ELCA right now. There's over 110 companion synod relationships, and lots of people excited about global mission, that a lot of learning needs to take place. So, Anne.
My name is Anne Basie, and I'm also with the Division for Global Mission, and I'm a housekeeper. That's my true identity and calling here at Holden. I work for DGM on what we call the Global Mission Education Team. So in a way, when you think about this continental geographic focus, we would be the North America team. So the group of five that I work with are responsible for trying to be another channel through which Global Mission, the gifts of the Global Church, our companions, come back to congregations through resources, of which, of course, I brought a few, through Global Mission events, through networks among people who are active in global issues. So that's the team that I'm on. So I don't actually have a specific geographical expertise the way that Mary does, having been a missionary in Central America and knowing a lot about the region. So I'm sort of more like, I'm the person in the pew who happens to work in the office trying to figure out what it is that we would all like to know as ELCA members about what the ELC does in global mission. I want to tell you a little bit about what we're doing and ask something first. Gwen has walked in, so I know there'll be one hand up when I ask the question. And has anyone ever served as a long or short-term missionary? Raises her hand. And how about a mission trip, a short-term mission trip? Okay.
Three.
And so we've clarified a compliment. Only a couple people know what a compliment is, but okay, Gwen does too. She's been there, done that, and Liz. To give you an overview of what we're doing this evening, we're going to start first of all with some definitions, video and us talking and meeting about what a compliment is. We're going to look a little bit at what, you know, how does that model compare with the way the ELCA and other denominations used to do global mission. So what has the shift actually been? We have a little more information for you after that. And then we have a discussion part that I think should be pretty interesting. And I'm going to be throwing in stories. My role in that education team is a writer and editor, so I always pay a lot of attention to the stories that come in from our missionaries. Missionaries, especially who are supported, have to do a lot of writing to their congregations that support them. So we get a lot of really great stories. So as appropriate, I'm going to be throwing in stories that I've just heard from people like Gwen, who served through DGM, that stories that kind of shed some light on what a compliment is. So I'll hit play while we're listening.
We're going to show you just a couple little pieces of the video. She'll show you one piece, and then I'll talk about the church in Malagasy, something about accompaniment. So,
from the Lutheran Church of Madagascar. This is from a video called Walking Together in Global Mission, of which we still have some copies. It's free from the Division for Global Mission, and it came out about 5 years ago when we were first beginning to educate on the accompaniment theology. so let's hope this works.
The Evangelical Lutheran Church in America's Global Mission 21 report. No kidding, the whole thing. What can I say? I spent a lot of time on airplanes. And as someone with an eager, if naive, interest in what we Lutherans do as missionaries, two words kept jumping off these yellow pages at me. Two words. Walking together. Hey, how do you say walking together in Malagasy?
Nyaradia.
Hey, Harry, how do you say walking together in French?
Allons ensemble.
Nyaradia. Walking together.
Okay. All right. Okay, now I'm going to, there is, our executive director is the Reverend Rafael Malpica Padilla, and he just wrote an article that was published in Word and World in the spring edition called The Accompaniment Model of Mission. I'm going to read a couple of the pieces from that so that you get kind of a flavor for what we're talking about. One could say that Lutherans have understood from the beginning that God works in the context of our everyday lives to restore and reconcile human community. This is the heritage of accompaniment as we understand it today, centered around God's mission of restoring community. A natural extension of this mission can be found in how Christian communities relate to one another. Accompaniment is about walking together that practices interdependence and mutuality. It asks the questions of how and what of mission in the context of relationships of a reconciling God and a human community that seeks reconciliation and wholeness. Now, he talks a little bit about what is the history, and some of you who don't know the history of mission might not be as interested in this, but what he talks about is back in 1910 at the Edinburgh Mission Conference, there was some discussion about the how and why of mission. And when we talk about the how, that's what we focus on in accompaniment. And then in the 19th century, the missionary efforts of the Protestant mission theory were toward the three self-marks that were developed in that time: self-governing, self-supporting, and self-propagating. Well, now a fourth self has been added with accompaniment, and that is self-articulation. And basically what that means is that the churches are in a position to make decisions in the world, or in the areas, are able to make their decisions for themselves and do their evangelism efforts and outreach efforts as they choose to do them, and education and the training of leadership, that these churches are no longer churches that are strong and established and have the ability to make these decisions about how these would be themselves. The change in Vatican II also affected us. Robert T. Rush provides an image that parallels Jesus' parable of pearls and treasures. Whereas mission had often been understood with the image of missionaries taking the gospel to every corner as pearl merchants, mission today can be described as hunting for treasures, discovering God's presence and revelation already present. As accompaniment attempts to live with the how and what of mission today, a primary reality is the mutual respect of the churches that are in relationship, the companions. The conversation is no longer between giver and receiver, but between churches, all of which have gifts to give and receive. The difference in kinds of gifts is not prioritized. Accompaniment seeks God's revelation and God's mission precisely within each context in which the church finds itself. It's about discovering the richness of gifts that emerge in a pastoral relationship. Accompaniment thus emphasizes relationship before resources. Development of programs and allocation of resources flow from how companions relate rather than vice versa. Accompaniment is valued for its own sake as well as for its results. It is open-ended with no foregone conclusions. The companions learn together in the journey. Accompaniment binds companions more closely to their Lord and further informs their mission. This makes accompaniment incarnational. It is about a God who is in mission among us, and it is about us being in mission with God and with others to whom God reaches out. Therefore, accompaniment is not only the doing of mission, but also is concerned about being in mission. It is about being transformed to be what God intends us to be, in relationship to God and in relationship with one another. And then now there's going to be a statement about... Oh,
I have a little more saying. I want to play again. Who remembers, you know, from your childhood, what missionaries did? Got a childhood memory of a missionary. My mother still talks about rolling bandages and putting them in tin cans and how excited she was, you know, 50 years later when she met a missionary and she said, did you really need all that stuff? And a missionary said, yeah, actually we use it a lot. So I have this memory that's probably from 60 years ago of a Sunday school class in my church rolling bandages. Anybody else? Nobody ever met a missionary when they were small? Nobody had an aunt or uncle who was a missionary? Jerry, you worked in aid for a long time. Tell me about it. Give me a story about a missionary.
I think it was kind of a romantic notion of going overseas and travel and culture and exotic places and so on.
It's still exotic and hard cross-cultural work. That hasn't changed. I just wanted to summarize a couple things of how when we think about, when DGM anyway thinks about the characteristics of our old paradigm, what some of the old is, and then we'll shift more to the new. So once upon a time, and still by some churches, mission was something directed by people here in North America or Europe. You know, we would naturally see ourselves as the people with the money, the people with the expertise, the people with the people, and with the global, with the centralized mission office in North America, we would be directing missions somewhere else. How that's changed is now the mission is directed locally. So as Mary was saying earlier, the you know, once upon a time missionaries went out to mission fields, but at least in the case of Lutherans, there's 65 million Lutherans and we are only 5 million of them. Most of the other 60 are outside the United States. Many are still in Europe, of course, because Europe still has state churches, but millions and millions are in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, and in most cases those churches are growing faster than ours is. So the model today would be to work, when we'll explore that more, but working on the ground with the church as a companion, and we'll get to that in a minute. Sending was sort of a paradigm. We send. Now it's more that we are called by the church on the ground and are supporting. As Mary said, relationship before resources. Work with the local church to find out what they need. I have here, missionaries served forever, and we never visited them. Because distances were so hard, there was no email, we couldn't travel inexpensively. So there was quite a gap, I think, between missionaries. And I was trying hard today to find a hymn that's in the Green Book that has a verse that's about, you know, fathers and mothers, don't be afraid to send your children and you'll see them in heaven or something, you know, because they're going to be gone in Africa for so long. But don't be afraid, give them up. And that's another aspect that's changed. So those are some. So mission directed by us here, us sending it as if there's nobody on the ground. That is pretty much the characteristic of the old model. And here is another, but maybe the word to use, advantages of the new model is often confirmed by our companion churches. And so this segment is with leaders of the Lutheran Church in Madagascar talking about their take on the accompaniment portion to mission. I think it works.
Of worship previously led by Europeans and Americans. Now there is much more indigenous worship, people using their own musical techniques and tones. Schools such as this one were originally started by missionaries. Now the schools are solely operated by the Malagasy, with the curriculum incorporating local customs, concepts, and concerns. Christian leadership meetings and organizations like this one were once headed by missionaries from the United States and Norway. Now, the leadership and the meetings are often chaired by Malagasy people.
Now, as you see the globalization of not only the church, but really the worldwide globalization, I think we tend now to new aspects of partnership. Not anymore someone pulling the man, come and follow me, but let us do it together for the sake of the gospel. I think of the church, that Malagasy will start more and more not to be in the leadership program. So the leadership will be run by Malagasy, because of course it's a Malagasy church, but the missionaries are always there also to work together.
We are starting our work at...
We have a document called the 12 signposts of accompaniment, walking together in the 21st century. And I don't know, maybe, has anyone seen this before? Okay, that's great. We're not gonna go through all 12 signposts of accompaniment because that would take us quite a long time. But basically, what this talks about is that accompaniment implies a process of movement together. And it's, again, it is a process. It's a process of learning, and that's certainly been the case in my life. I'm going to hold up about four of these. I mean, some of them are, these are really important, and anybody who wants to get a copy of this, just leave us with your address, and we'll be sure to send you one, because we have some, you know, at the Division for Global Mission. But some of the signposts, I think, are really critical for those of us who live in the United States as we go on mission trips, or as we go in companion synod visits, or as we become missionaries. One of them, you know, I picked a couple that I think really speak to us. One is witness under the cross, and it's number two. The church witnesses from a position defined by the cross of Jesus Christ. In its attitude and actions, it seeks to witness to the world from the servant stance of vulnerability and compassion. And what does that mean? What's the question there? The question is, do we as people in the ELCA listen respectfully to the people that we seek to serve and demonstrate that we are willing to rethink the cultural values inherent in our programs and methods? I think some of, I don't know about you, but when I was a missionary in El Salvador, and before I went, I was a little uncomfortable with even the term missionary. It took me a while to get used to that whole idea, because I had seen, our culture is telling us now that all of that is bad, you know, that we did some things that were cross-culturally incorrect, and it made me uncomfortable. But I think that there's a lot of learning that takes place about crossing cultures. It's not something that you can learn all in one and it takes you there. But I think this is a good question, and it's something that we always need to be willing to ask ourselves. And it says here that we will negotiate country strategies that adequately address the companion church's expressed needs. That means we listen. We do more listening than talking. Another one that I chose that I think will especially appeal to the people that I know are sitting here that come to Holden is justice, peace, and the integrity of creation. The LCA is situated within a wealthy world superpower. Recognizing the strengths and limitations of its situation, we will pursue programs of justice, peace, and the integrity of creation by advocating for and identifying with people most affected by injustice, repression, and degradation of their environment. Our active participation in concerns for justice, peace, and the integrity of creation aligns us with God's final work of fulfillment. And the question is, do we respond with intentional concern with companion churches whose gifts are repressed by colonialism, racism, economic deprivation, politics, or gender inequality? And the other question is, are we mobilizing our constituency to publicly witness within the U.S. society on the concerns for justice, peace, and the integrity of creation? And that's something that we also just work on continually. For the LCA constituency, do we evaluate the positive and negative influences of our status as U.S. citizens, and what role that has in global mission? And then I chose a couple other ones that I wanted to mention that I think really come into my work in companion synods. I think that most people who are exposed to accompaniment in the companion synod program really want this to be the way that they operate, but often it's a process of learning, and it can be stumbling blocks. One of them is transparency in communication and finance. Communication among companions is open and honest, transparent. That we strive to reflect an accurate picture of motivations, programs, and budgets, and mutual accountability, and we assume that between ourselves and our companions. And then the question is, do we in the LCA and our companion churches reflect in conversations and our conversations our mutual strengths and weaknesses within our mission, calling within our respective cultures? You know, are we always going to come out of our strengths, or are we willing to admit that there is something that we need to learn? And I think that one of the things that I see with people that are excited about going on mission trips is because they know there's something out there to learn, and they want to get into it, and they want to be part of it. But we need to always be mindful of the fact that in communication and in finance, that there's, we could go all kinds of, spend a lot of time talking about how money can really get into the way of relationships, and that we often don't feel when we send our money that our money is also crossing cultures. You know, we send with our money certain cultural assumptions about how it's going to be used, or certain cultural assumptions about what we expect, you know, from other people. And it's a very, very knotty situation. And then the last one that I really wanted to hold up, and I really encourage everybody to get a copy of this document to learn more about accompaniment, is shared decision making. The accompaniment model assumes that decisions are made through consultation. We will consult with the constituency and companion churches to clarify practices for making decisions. The question is, are the ELCA's companion churches participants in conversations leading to decisions affecting them? Do we work together, or do we just decide? And that's a big issue. And we do the consultations that we have. It's a chance for us to listen. But when we listen, does it change our actions? And that's something that we always need to be looking at.
Let me jump in for a minute.
Yeah.
For our next segue, I brought a few copies of our Global Mission Annual, and maybe before we continue talking about accompaniment, we start a discussion, let's just look at, in the middle of this, you'll find a map that shows you basically where the ELCA is working today. So we can just talk in terms of people and numbers. The ELCA has about 300 missionaries who work around the world. I forget the number of countries. Every month, the number of missionaries is slightly different, and the number of countries slightly different too. But I would say there's about 52 different countries, and they're all in here. So in the middle spread is a map that shows you where the ELCA is at work today. Sometimes a church, a companion church, wants us to provide staff. And in that case, the agreement is made with the church. What kind of help do they need? Often it's very technical. We think of missionaries as being pastors. We'll get into this more in the week. But often a church, the Church of Papua New Guinea, for example, speaking of financial transparency, asked us for an accountant to help them with transparency, to help them in a culture in which there's not even actual paper money in some of the villages in Papua New Guinea. The need for some basic financial accountant skills for their church was pretty critical. The dark colored color shows you where there are people. The lighter color, so if you look like the lighter purple in Asia, that's where we would send, at the request of churches, a block grant, and they would use it for their own work. So those are the two different ways of work. So just to let you know that when we talk about accompaniment, we are accompanying 70 different countries, Lutheran churches, in 70 countries around the world. We have a couple more comments about accompaniment before we go into our discussion. From Latin America, of course.
Well, I was just going to say that we want to open this up for people's own experiences, and it seems like this group is something many people in this group haven't had an opportunity to really learn too much about accompaniment.
But we do have one expert, and that's Gwen Wirtz, who will be talking in a few minutes, we hope, when we call on her.
there's a book that's in the bookstore called Like Grains of Wheat, A Spirituality of Solidarity. And this is really an excellent book because it is a gathering of experiences of people that served in Central America, particularly in the 80s and the 90s. And what Margaret Swedish and Marie Dennis tried to do is ask them, how did they get into it, first of all, into this kind of work? And what changed as a result of being part of this work? And what has happened to them since they've returned to the United States? What are they doing now? And how have their attitudes changed? What have they learned? This is all, it's about accompaniment in a different way. I think those people, those of you who may have heard about or been involved in anything in the 80s and the 90s with Central America knew that the word accompaniment was thrown around a lot. But we went to accompany the people. When people went on delegations to visit in those countries, they went for the accompaniment purpose. So people went in accompaniment, and what happened to them as a result of that. And so what I thought I would do is just read a section of this book and then just say, what strikes you and what does this remind you of, or what would you like to share about how accompaniment is really a hard process. For me, I can say that I was a missionary in El Salvador for 5 years, and when I came into the Lutheran Church, The first thing that Leonardo Gomez said to me, he's the bishop of the Church of El Salvador, he sat me down and he said, I want you to know one thing, you will never be in charge of anything. And you know, you are here to be with us, you are here to work with us, but you're never going to be the boss. And I thought, you know, at first I was okay with that because my Spanish wasn't even good enough to think about being a boss. But on the other hand, I just felt like, wow, you know, that's a limitation. But the fact that he said that to me, we put that out on the table, and I understood that, was very freeing. And it gave me the opportunity to be in service and know that I was not going to be called upon to do some of those things. I mean, that didn't mean that I didn't have a very strong supportive role, but I was never the director of an office. And so, you know, that was kind of where accompaniment really took its meaning for me. But let me just share this with you and see what your thoughts are. You want to open this up to your feelings. We live in a culture with a hierarchy of who is valued, says one former missionary. Others say that in the United States, the dominant culture assumes that not all lives are equal, that some are expendable, that the role of others in the world, millions of people, is to provide for our comfort. The underlying assumption is that U.S. Americans are more human than anyone else. As Sabrina points out very profoundly, our general assumption in Western Europe and the United States and Canada is that people in the rest of the world are on their way to becoming human beings. We're there, and someday they'll catch up. This reflects remnants of perhaps a Calvinist underpinnings of this culture. We've done so well because our economic thinking is in line with the proper theology. Our success, our wealth, is evidence of our superiority. If that is the value, then it means that those who don't make it, those who do not succeed, or who fall between the cracks, are somehow less than human. This is reflected in some of the policy priorities, for example, in that we know that the United States spends less than 0.5% of its annual budget on foreign assistance. Most of this aid goes not to the poorest countries or populations with the greatest needs, but to the countries that have strategic interests. John Sobrino, a theologian from El Salvador, asks, who is going to control the definition of what it is to be a human being? White, male, doctor, PhD, what about women, Africans, and so on? Who is going to define that? Maybe no one is doing that openly, but in the collective consciousness of a society, there is an implicit definition of what is a human being and what is not. So this is, the reason that this has to do with accompaniment, you know, it has to do with, do we really think that we are better? Can we really walk in partnership? Can we really be in companionship with other people?
I guess I have a question, maybe it goes a little bit off track, because I wonder, I mean, regardless of our ideals and what we want to be and how we want to present ourselves to others, it seems to me that the question of money is always going to get in the way. I mean, the cheerful man skipping down the road, if he's the one with a wallet, it's going to complicate things. Now, that's why I was curious if in the accompaniment, you know, programs, what has been done to funding? Has funding changed at all to reflect these new ideals? I mean, in terms of how funds are dispersed and how programs and personnel are implemented and hired and so on. Is there more of a parallel?
Well, there actually is, and there's a big struggle about that because there are a whole bunch of people that say, well, Global Mission's not doing its job because the missionary numbers are going down. You know, that's one of the, and that's really a false, in one sense it's true, the numbers of North American missionaries that are being sent maybe goes down, but we spend a lot of money in leadership development, which means that the scholarship money for church leaders from all over the world to study and to develop is makes the numbers even higher than what they were before. So yes, there has been a shift in the way we spend our money now, but there's a lot of stress with people saying, oh, the numbers are going down, there's something bad about that, we shouldn't be doing that, and they don't see that there is this other thing that's happening, and they don't see that what we are doing is in response to what the companion churches are asking us to do. We're not making these decisions on our own. And that when we send a missionary now, a missionary goes there with the idea of being replaced, not by another missionary, but being replaced by someone in that church that now takes that position.
And so you saw that in the video, how, you know, proud he was to say, well, how much John the narrator said and how much the man from the church was talking about, you know, administered by Mel Gacy. There's a, and I just borrowed this, there's a, I'll read another quote from the Bishop of Malawi. It says, the ELCA and the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Malawi are partners. In partnership, you have to trust the partner on the ground so that you achieve activities through them. We run our local projects with assistance from the ELCA. There are no missionaries in Malawi. This is a block grant. This is a pattern which we from Africa have been advocating for because it empowers us to achieve our own goals. So, yes, it's true that the number of missionaries has been decreasing, but a lot, the ELCA is an incredible partner in many, many places through people on the ground, the troops on the ground.
So the block, grants are fairly open-ended? I mean, they don't.
I shouldn't use block grant. What I mean is large sum of money transferred to a particular program in another country. I don't know. There are some, I think, block grants, but mostly when Mary said our money, you know, when we send our money, we're sending our values. That is true. There's some accountability built in. Usually it's for a particular program someplace administered by the church.
But not necessarily with personnel to implement the program.
Mm-hmm. And that seems to be what bothers people, some people the most, is that. Mm-hmm. And that the personnel should be going as opposed to that.
Why aren't we, you know, how do we know what's happening to our money when it gets there? There's a lot of trust here. Mm-hmm. You know, and if we've defined ourselves as the human beings and sort of infantilized other people, which, I mean, this is a long time ago, this is not recent, but that attitude lingers in some people. Can we trust them to do the job which we think secretly in our hearts we can do better because we can do anything? So.
Any other?
Jeffy.
One thing that strikes me about it is it's one way. It's always us to them. So I'm curious if if these countries ever send missionaries to us and for, say, there's a developing Hispanic community or something like that.
Yeah.
Bring people here.
I'd like to make the receiving speech, and you can talk about Malawi.
Yeah,
all right.
Well,
the receiving speech is also, there are four goals for DGM, and those are also, can you see how proud I am? Right on page two there. Our four goals are proclaim, as the kid might say, serve, accompany, and receive. And receive is a new part of the model, which means acknowledge that the gifts of the world are legion, and we need to have a little modesty about that. So my team, the education team, basically is charged with receiving, so that through bringing people in for, like Lima Boe from Liberia was here a few weeks ago, so she had come for a little mission event. She came here to hold it for a week. Through the exchange of people, through big events, we really work hard so that, and I think anybody here who's traveled or hosted a visitor from someone else understand is overwhelmed by the gifts that you get. So there is more of an exchange now, whereas in the past it was more sending. There's a famous story that comes from the British Missionary Society that decided, probably with the local church in Uganda, that they were going to send bicycles to evangelists in Uganda. So they worked out the details with the church, and then the church wrote a nice little note and said, well, now what can we send you? But they didn't get a response. So they continue to negotiate the deal. And Uganda again writes the letter, you know, well, what can we give you? No response. A third iteration of this, and the third time the Missionary Society, this is a long time ago, said, well, no, there's nothing you need to give us. And then the Uganda church said, then we will not take a gift. If there's nothing we can give you, you have nothing to give us. So that kind of parity in exchanges is important today. Can I call on Gwen to maybe talk a little bit about this? Gwen Wirtz is on staff here, and she was a participant in the Young Adults and Global Mission Program, which we'll give more details for in a couple of days. And she served in Kenya for a year and wrote fabulous, speaking of missionary writers, fabulous essays and reflections on what it was like to accompany people in Kenya. So, want to talk a bit about that?
Yeah, well, one of the best
I'm gonna stand up.
Okay.
So the mic can hear you.
Move my feet. One of the best things I thought I could do is just tell you sort of a story of something that happened while I was there that illustrates, I think, ELCA's model of accompaniment. I was teaching at a very rural high school in the southeastern corner of Kenya, and I was the only Westerner in that area, and I wasn't around any sort of other mission personnel from the ELCA. I was very much alone, very much living in the community of the Luo people that I was surrounded by. And in Kenya, school violence is a very serious problem. Students protest in the form of what they call strikes, which here is a peaceful walkout. In Kenya, a strike is a riot. And it's they're very violent, and students throw stones and broken bottles, and often students are beaten, buildings are burned, teachers are killed, and they're disastrous, and they happen all the time, especially in the universities, but in the high schools as well. And every day in the paper, you'll read about at least 3 schools that have had strikes. And then for the 3 that you've heard about, there's been 10 others that you haven't heard about. And it happens everywhere, in every school, girls' school, boys' schools, mixed schools, boarding schools, and day schools. It was something that when I first learned about it in Kenya, you know, I asked a lot of why does this happen? And nobody could really give me a good answer. It's not really that violent of a country. Comparatively, in Africa, Kenya is a very safe place to be. But the schools are not, for some reason, for some very complicated reasons. So when I got to my school, I talked to the other teachers about this, and they said, you know, the school hasn't had a strike. We've been fine so far. But as I got more comfortable in my situation there and sort of started to get to know teachers and students better, I started to hear whispers of strike and, you know, threats of it in some ways. And at the beginning of my year, I was really nervous about that, and I actually took a week out and I went to Nairobi because I was actually afraid, you know, what would happen if there was a strike at my school, and who knows what the cause would be. But the cause doesn't really matter once a strike gets going. Everybody kind of gets drawn into it, and people are hurt that weren't intended to be hurt. And so anyway, I was afraid, and so I went to Nairobi for a week and ended up coming back and decided, well, I'll stick this out and it'll be fine. By the end of the year, our school actually had the strike that I was so afraid would happen. And I woke up at about 2 in the morning, and I heard rocks on the roof of the houses. They all have metal roofs, and breaking glass and screams and yells. And I thought, oh my God, this is it. So I tried to turn on my lights, but the students had cut the power cords. I never told this story. You might not want to take this back. And the students had cut the power cord, so all the electricity was gone from the compound. And so, you know, my hands were shaking, and I lit my gas lantern, and I decided, well, the safest place for me to be is not right here. I've only got, you know, I've got 2 doors, but, you know, if students decide for some reason that I'm a target of this in any way, or in their drunkenness or rage that I'm a part of this, you know, I'm in a very unsafe place. So I lit my lantern and decided to run out into the bush and through this little ravine. Anyway, a friend lived down the way, sort of in the bush, and so I decided that's where I would go. And so I lit my lantern and headed off behind sort of the compound, behind the teachers' houses, and encountered another teacher sort of crouching in the bush back there. And I said, what is going on? And he said, you need to go back to your house. You shouldn't be out here. And I said, well, I was concerned. I heard the voices coming this way, and all the screaming and the shouting, and I wasn't quite sure what to do. And he said, you know, they're actually after us. The focus was 2 particular teachers that the students were angry with. And he said, you're safe, they won't hurt you, but you do need to go back to your house. You're safer there than you are out here. So I went back, I blew out my lantern, and I walked back to my house and locked the door. And, the story kind of goes on and on. But anyway, ultimately, the night passed and no serious damage was done. A house was fairly destroyed, but the 2 teachers that they had targeted were not killed. They did escape and didn't continue working at the school that they lived. And I had a choice at that point to make, whether to talk to my site coordinator and say, this thing has happened and I feel unsafe here and I need to go, or to stay. Mm-hmm. And I chose not to tell her because I knew that I would be removed. And at that point, it was so important for me to remain in a situation that every Kenyan teacher and student lives with. If they had accepted me in their community, it was a situation that I had to be a part of. And so I stayed. And I never told Steve Nelson, who was in charge of my program. I did have to write out
your parents.
I did, yeah.
Okay.
But I did have to write out a note to Steve saying, should anything happen to me in the next 3 days, I stay here of my own will. And it was incredibly important to both the students and the teachers and to me that was the case. Mm-hmm. One of the teachers who left was the only other English teacher. One of the teachers who was chased out was the only other English teacher. And if I had left as well, the students would have been without English teachers and wouldn't have had their English exams and would have had to reset their year for English classes. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the best model that I can think of accompaniment, but it definitely evolved. At the beginning of the year, it wasn't something I would have done, but by the end of the year, it was essential to my mission in Kenya.
Well,
that's why you just said why it's a process. Mm-hmm. You know, it's absolutely a process. It's a course of learning. There's a friend of mine who's on our companion synod committee. Thank you. Who says that in the years now, she's been involved with El Salvador and our companion synod relationship since about the year 2000. She said, somebody said, well, you know, what do you think now? And she said, you know, I look back sometimes and I cringe at things that I did, you know, 5 years ago that now maybe I wouldn't do, but it's a course of learning over time, you know, and we know that God forgives us, and we also know that people forgive too, because they know that the intentions are good, but, you know, we try. Just to address your question, yes, I would say that there's a couple things. One thing that I always tell companion synod committees is if they're sending more people on visits and not bringing people to visits in their synod, you know, then they're missing part of it. You know, there's a question of mutuality. They're not acting in a mutual way. We now have a situation where there are some companion synods in the United States that are bringing people to come for even a longer period of time to be missionaries in their own synod. And that's what's happening with us from the Lutheran Church of El Salvador. We have Walter and Betty Baides, who are two pastors, Salvadoran pastors, who are now working in the Greater Milwaukee Synod. And there is also another pastor, Elias Katoy, from the Meru Diocese of Tanzania, who has come to the Milwaukee Synod to work, and our missionaries in reverse. And they are teaching us many, many things about evangelism. Pastor Elias gives talks about, you know, the church in Tanzania is growing by leaps and bounds, and he talks about how it's growing and what they're learning. And our pastors are getting much benefit out of that kind of learning. So we definitely have to look at the mutuality question when we talk about receiving. Anybody else who wants to ask a question?
I guess I'm interested in how much training people get before they actually leave to go there. I guess I have some. Maybe it's just a bias that's not accurate anymore, that there isn't enough training, that people don't get into enough depth of really understanding the culture they're going into.
Well, I think at this point, the training process for most people is there is an ecumenical orientation that takes place. The LCA participates with the Presbyterian Church and when the Episcopal Church sends people, and the volunteer missionary movement too, they all get together and go through the training together. And there's tremendous value in that because, you know, it's a very big group and they get a lot of chances to learn together before they go. And then the ELCA has a one-week ELCA-specific orientation that takes place where they learn more about what it's, you know, the ELCA mission policies and we get a chance, they learn more about where they're going, they learn more about what they might be able to expect.
How long is that training, or what really does it?
Well, the total is about 3 weeks that they're in training.
That's here, before they get to where they're going.
Right.
Then there would be more on the ground training.
And then there's orientation that takes place when they get there. It depends on the person and how that takes place. I know there's some other models, like, you know, maybe you're familiar with the Maryknoll model, that's like 6 months orientation, where they actually go to New York and they spend 6 months before they get a chance to go. There is also language study that needs to take place for people as well. So I guess there could be a question about whether that's even enough, and there are missionaries that say that maybe that isn't enough. When one of our sessions that we're going to be talking about crossing cultures, one of the things that we're going to be able to share at that is pieces from a paper that somebody wrote, what I wish I had known before I left, you know, and this has to do with crossing cultures. Some of those issues have to do with crossing cultures.
That's something that goes on for years and years, because as the story reader for missionaries, I mean, some of our longest-term missionaries still are writing stories about, you know, look at this amazing thing that happened the other day. I thought I kind of got this culture, and it turns out I don't. So, for example, we have a long, there is, not we have, there is a long-term missionary in Indonesia named Rosie Kameo, who teaches at the Satya Wacana Christian University with her husband. And always very interesting letters looking at a multi-faith setting and a very important ministry and a really keen observer of cross-cultural differences. So she wrote a little story once about how she was giving a test, you know, she was sitting there in the classroom and it was clear to her that the girls in front were cheating. They were sharing answers. So, you know, the class ends, the test is over, she comes up and she starts to berate her student, "Why did you do that?" And the student said, "Well, you know, more important is to assist our friends whenever assistance is needed." So then she had to sit down and say, "Oh, right, you know." even after 20 years, mm-hmm. I want this, but here's this other value of supporting your community that's just as important. And so it really made her wrestle. Where was she going to draw the line as a teacher between, you know, when is learning rendered effective because you're sharing lesson answers on the test, and when are you respecting the local culture?
So maybe part of the more important training than the actual culture is the really being aware of being very open and very yeah. listening
that
and very
training.
Open to learning about yeah. the culture.
And that's a really big part of what happens at the ecumenical orientation. Mm-hmm. They get it theologically, they get it in all other, you know, from you know, sociologically. I mean, they get it from all kinds of different aspects, but it's open, be flexible, open, you know, and mm-hmm. some people are just like, well, I want to know what that really means. And it's going to be different for everybody. You had a question.
Well, I just had a response to your question, too. I spent 5 months studying and teaching in Tanzania, in Dar es Salaam. And I had some orientation before I left. But I think that it's dangerous to have the idea when you go that you know what you need to know. Because 5 minutes off the plane, what you smell, see, hear, and feel is going to be more than 5 weeks or 5 months in a different, like here, where you're not in the culture. So I think that sort of training that tells you to be open and to be flexible is probably the most important advice that you could get.
Any other questions or comments? Yeah, go ahead.
Another informational question.
Sure.
I was curious, I mean, most of the American personnel that is sent over work with the local Lutheran churches, whether it's a school or church, or is there some collaboration with local government kind of things too, or?
Not government.
No, not at all. And in fact, there's a prohibition, you know, toward having any kind of employment with the government, with ours or the governments in other countries.
So the schools are all church schools?
Church schools.
Yeah, that's a murky issue that could be another session. How the context for U.S. missionaries, you know, they almost feel they're not missionaries of the gospel. They are just representatives of the United States. So I was rereading a story again tonight from Cairo where, you know, a wonderful man, David Grafton, who teaches at the seminary there, was describing a taxi trip, a typical ride across Cairo with a taxi driver who first talks about politics and backs up to what he does for Lism, you know, then into a nice, safe discussion about family and then moves back into faith, you know. And so, you know, he says again and again in this context, he feels like he has to clear the whole U.S. question before he can get to the gospel. And so for that reason, many missionaries in many contexts are basically told to just minimize their contact with the embassy. You're part of the church. Don't confuse it in the country where you are because it's very easy to do these days. It's pretty charged.
Well, just a couple of some statistics that might be helpful. The Lutheran World Federation, of which the LCA is a member, obviously with Bishop Hansen also being the president at this point in time, it has 138 different Lutheran bodies. Well, there, I would say most of them are Lutheran. There's a couple that Protestant bodies that have come and affiliated with the Federation. And so the LCA, as part of that whole communion, has those relationships. But there are more than 70 that the LCA, Lutheran churches, that the LCA has what would be considered special relationships with, historic relationships. And this year, the LCA, the Division for Global Mission, is looking at increasing that number. We're looking at the possibility of up to 5 new relationships with new Lutheran churches.
Can you explain what happens what happens when the ELCA is in relationship with a companion church? What does that mean to us?
Well, you explained it pretty well, but going back to that map there, you can see where we have relationships and what they can see, what they may, what kind of resources are involved. And that's what that map really shows you. It shows you where they are and what kind of resources are involved. But basically what that means is that we have entered into a kind of relationship of accompaniment where we're walking with this church, we're responding to what that means with that church, to their requests. And in some ways there is some financial input that if we are taking on a relationship, we can't say, oh well, we're just gonna pray for you. You know, that's the full extent of what we're gonna do. So there are financial consequences, and then sometimes somewhat limits us in some ways to be in a number of relationships. But these are at least 70 churches right now that we are walking with. And that means that in the continental teams, the program directors are visiting those churches on a regular basis. We now have a system of regional representatives, which means that we may have an on-the-ground person. For example, we have somebody who's a regional representative for Central America who visits those churches probably much more frequently than one program director can do, you know, the director of the desk. And so he's there at least every 3 months or so, visiting each one. He's also able to visit the missionaries that we have in those places as well.
So I would just say to sum up that for me what's exciting about a compliment that we may not have gotten across to you is that as I began to learn as a person who joined DGM 5 years ago, what a compliment meant, the mutual respect, the equal relationship of gifts, the lack of hierarchy. You know, it really made me start to evaluate even ministries domestically that same way. You know, is our church doing something that's just objectifying somebody sending money and not listening to what they want? We are just as likely to do that here. So if you think in terms of a compliment, which is actually a very difficult thing to achieve, and we don't want to give you the impression that the ELCA is doing it 100% of the time, let me tell you, some of these relationships, historic and new, are kind of troubling today. And people do make mistakes all the time, which is why it's good there's forgiveness. But the model of thinking of yourself as in a servant relationship with someone in a relationship that's equal instead of hierarchical kind of affects how you evaluate a lot of the ministries that your church is doing domestically as well as internationally. And we are developing a handbook for the Companion Synod program that will come out that has some good checklists for like evaluating if you're envisioning a mission project for your church, kind of a checklist for deciding whether you're engaging in this authentically through a compliment or whether you're just perpetuating a model that we should just all move away from, in which other people are just, you know, we're directing the show, someone else is the beneficiary, and that's the end of the relationship, because that is harmful wherever it takes place.
Anne gave me a segue to a comment that something I was thinking about as we were talking about receiving. I know, because most of you weren't here last week, I know that the gifts I received last week during the Abrianos Camino were 100 times more than the gifts the people received that came from our Latino communities. It was just amazing. And just, you know, it's so quiet this week. Oh my goodness! The silence is deafening. But the gifts, the resources that the Latino community showed us about how to worship and how to be in community with their families and their neighbors and the use of music, and it was just wonderful.
And I would say that the planning model that Holton uses also in developing that is a good example.
A good model.
Of compliment, working with local leaders, you know, this is so that the steering committee,
right,
made up of people who are going to be coming, is actually saying it would be better if it happened this way,
right,
here's a good thing. So it's definitely a lot of listening and shaping the program to meet the needs of the community that's concerned, instead of just saying, let's make it, well, of course, they have to scrape their plates. Everybody has to do that. There are some things don't change, but basically,
yeah,
listening and designing to meet needs. So probably.
Well, one of the things
looking at the book and kind of a real quick review, it looks like one question that pops out of me is kind of the numbers. There's a large number of them in the United Kingdom.
Oh.
And that's a small Lutheran.
Yeah.
The number is there. And then if you look at Indonesia, there's
three or four million
Lutherans, you've got one missionary.
And so. One missionary. I could address that. Yeah. The reason there are a lot of people in the United Kingdom is that for the last 5 years we have been growing a program called Young Adults in Global Mission, which is a sort of a separate one-year program, an alternative to the Peace Corps, basically, that's through the Lutheran Church. We'll talk a lot more about it later in the week, but if you're 19 to 30, you qualify, and that's how Gwen went to Kenya. The programs, the first place that we had as a placement was in the United Kingdom because it's through a program called Time for God, which I think is a PCUSA program. So that's still a popular place for the young people to go, and they work in social service ministries. It's still cross-cultural, even though it's England instead of the United States. But so they're serving in parishes and in social services there. So wherever there's a young adult placement, the numbers are going to be a little bit higher. Otherwise, some big countries where we have missionaries, Tanzania, of course, because that's an historical relationship. And there are many people who volunteer for 3, 6, and 9 months whose pictures don't necessarily show up here. And through these companion synod programs that link an individual synod with an individual church or synod around the world, there are more exchanges happening. So this is just a portion of the work that the ELCA carries on as a whole body. So Tanzania still has lots of people. You'll see that Slovakia has many people. They're all teachers. Now, why would we send people to Slovakia? Because if you look at the Eastern European churches, those are churches that are strong, historic Lutheran churches, but they had a 60-year hiatus when they really couldn't do much. And during that time, no pastors were trained. Buildings were changed to other uses. I remember 2 years ago when we had LWF guests, we had a woman from Russia, showed us pictures of her church as a church, then as a swimming pool, then as a community hall, and now finally to get it back as a church. But it's had so many other uses, it's going to take a while to kind of recover it as a worship space. But the government turned a church into a swimming hall. So those churches have asked ELCA to support its schools and seminaries with teachers to upgrade, to train a whole lot of people who can go and continue to lead a church that was without leadership for a long time, where all the pastors are 85, and now they're 30 also, but there's a big gap in the middle. There was nobody in the middle. So we're going to do other sessions this week. Just quickly tomorrow, we'll look at globalization from the accompaniment point of view. What are churches doing about that? As Mary pointed out, most of our companion churches are the source of requests for advocacy. Of course, we have our social statements, but the Church of El Salvador is very specific in asking the U.S. Church to do certain things on its behalf. So through globalization, we can kind of address globalization from the eyes of our companion churches.
That's that is a pure example of how this takes place. The churches in Central America, all of them unanimously said that they were against the CAFTA, the Free Trade Agreement. They all asked us to advocate. They asked all of their companion synods to be involved in that. And so now in the true accompaniment model, we're going to be talking about this again, because even though CAFTA just passed and one vote would have made a big difference there, Lutherans had something to say. You know, the Lutheran delegation in Congress, really, we can be proud of them, the way they voted. They didn't all vote the right way, but it was very positive. And the whole reason that we got involved with this was because we were asked by our companions to do that. So that's what we're going to talk about, globalization tomorrow. And then we're going to talk about crossing cultures, you know, the assumptions we make, a little bit more about, you know, what it is, what do we take with us, what's the baggage we take with us when we travel, you know, and how can we maybe disabuse ourselves a little bit of our own cultural assumptions, or at least recognize them so that we can, you know, we can try to act in an accompaniment way. And then we're going to talk about mission opportunities for service, and that will include short-term mission trips. We're going to talk about that. And finally, we'll have one session on the Latin American churches, so that you can learn something about the differences between the churches. And, I mean, aren't they all Catholic? And there's a presumption that, and for a long time, the LCA wasn't as active in Latin America. So thank you for coming.
Thank you. We forgot to tell you that we are two of the fastest talkers.